I just have the feeling. That's why I'm going to keep away from you.
You know.
What?
I wonder why I'm like that.
Like what?
I'm never thinking about anybody except myself.
Well, you don't think I'd go without you?
You mean that, Stan?
Absolutely. You satisfied?
Oh, Stan, I don't care for nothing now. Nothing in the world.
You're not a regular MD, are you?
Of course not. But anything my patients reveal to me is as sacred as though it were given under the seal of the confessional. Is that clear?
All right, you don't have to get on a soapbox. I'm going to be strictly on the level about this whole thing myself.
Will you get out of here? I should have known you were that kind of a...
It takes one to catch one. Listen to me. I'm no good. I never pretended to be. But I love you. I'm a hustler. I've always been one. But I love you. I may be the thief of the world, but with you, I've always been on the level.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books, and especially Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, The Atom Age, by John Woolley, Jan Allen Henderson, and yours truly. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And, indeed, it's my pleasure to introduce the man who brings you comics from the gone world, as well as the originator, really, with George Turner, of the Forgotten Horrors series. And without that series and without Michael Price, we wouldn't have this podcast. So, Michael Price.
So glad you made it.
One more round again, Michael. And tonight, under the microscope, I guess, is Nightmare Alley.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about Nightmare Alley, it's really not exactly, I guess, a good place to start, or perhaps let me start with a synopsis of it. It's about a kind of a hustler who hooks on with a carnival, goes through a mind-reading act, Tyrone Power plays the character.
A phony mentalist involved with him, not unlike the situation in Elmer Gantry.
Exactly, and it gets more like the situation in Elmer Gantry as things go on, and he becomes a spiritualist, and is in fact building a temple to himself. When the whole thing comes crashing back down, he finds himself at the carnival again, not to give too much away. It's based on a book by one of my favorite writers, and I think one of the great writers who is unsung, one of the great American writers, that's William Lindsay Gresham. We'll talk about him a little bit later on. But one of the things you probably won't find this film in any of the Forgotten Horrors books, although we've already passed that, haven't we? Because it's a big picture. In some ways.
Major studio.
Edmund Goulding, the director, had done, Dark Victory with Betty Davis and Grand Hotel. And Tyrone Power was the lead. Now, Tyrone Power wasn't quite the box office draw. Correct me if I'm wrong here. Wasn't quite the box office draw he'd been before he went into the service.
Well, the service did that to a lot of careers, including the number one box office draw of the mid-depression years, Gene Autry.
That's correct. And both of those guys...
You get in and do your duty, and the public tends to forget about you.
That's right. Both those guys acquitted themselves very well as flyers. and Tyrone Power came back. So it's kind of, it's either a really good A picture or a really good B picture or a nervous A picture, and I wonder where you would put it, Michael. What would
Fox
you?
Fox never made a B looking picture. The so called B pictures from Fox differed only from the top of the line product in that they dealt in themes that the big box office blockbusters wouldn't touch. The Michael Shane pictures, for example, the Charlie Chans, but they all had that sheen of professionalism, accomplishment. Every dollar on screen, no matter whether it was $25,000 or a couple of million.
That's right.
And the and of course, that wartime period saw the bigger studios rethinking a lot of their policies, their philosophies about what kind of pictures should be made. Of course, Nightmare Alley gets caught up in the film noir movement of the post-war years, that dark underbelly of society attitude.
With a film fatale, of course. In
yes. We think of the post-war years as a time of comparative prosperity, but they also were a time of extreme communal doubt among the American people. And therefore, you find these larger pictures addressing themes of, for want of a better word, existential quandaries.
And also, I think the role of women in post-war society, which sure shows up in Nightmare Alley.
Oh, yeah, that's a distinct step forward in both the social strata and in the willingness of Hollywood to go beyond the general division of genre roles. And it's a picture that probably couldn't have been made during happier times for the country. You see this reflected in depression pictures, late 20s, early 30s pictures such as The Charlatan, such as The 13th Guest with its indictment of wealth, 1932, depths of the Depression, the pictures of the wartime, which of course was probably a more troubled time than any, tended to be more upbeat because home front audiences during the war and the soldiers overseas wanted to see pictures that, that made them feel good.
Exactly. There was enough misery to go around in the newsreels, certainly.
Yes, and Nightmare Alley is anything but a feel-good picture.
Absolutely. And you know what puts me in mind, and this may be a little bit of a stretch, but it puts me in mind of another very adaptation, 20th Century Fox adaptation of a very famous American novel that had an ending, the novel, that couldn't be filmed. And I'm thinking about The Grapes of Wrath.
Grapes of Wrath, exactly.
Because just like The Grapes of Wrath, even though the ending is pretty downbeat, not so much in Grapes of Wrath, I think Nightmare Alley is more a downbeat ending than Grapes of Wrath, but Nightmare Alley could not do the ending that the book had. And the ending that the book had of Nightmare Alley, I believe that's where so much of its power lies, and it can only be hinted at on the screen.
Well, the motion picture industry also was under the thrall of the Legion of Decency.
Yes.
Which really discouraged frankness.
Frankness?
You don't find, not to say that it's a happy ending by any means, but it's like, it adheres to the production code administration's rule that the offender must get what's coming to him, not to give too much away.
Right, exactly. Well, it's an odd grouping of people. I think Tyrone Power, there was some of the things I read about the film. Tyrone Power kind of had to work pretty hard to get this assignment because it's not a particularly heroic role at all. The protagonist role is not heroic at all.
It's a role that probably would have more easily or logically gone to Robert Mitchum.
Yes, exactly.
Who was on his way up as a film noir anti-hero.
perfect casting would have been Tom Neill, but I don't think he was ever on the 20th Century Fox.
Tom Neill would have been perfect for it, as would have Lawrence Tierney.
Exactly.
But of course, they tended to play out their movie roles in real life, if you know what I mean.
Right. Well, monogram and real life. Pretty
yeah,
much
exactly. And getting in Dutch with the law
right.
is one thing in the movies, but quite a career-changing activity in real life. Even Mitchum had his share of brushes, although he became too valuable to the major studios for them to dismiss lightly.
That's right.
A guy like Tom Neill of Edgar Ulmer's famous low budgeter Detour could get in a scrape over an altercation, a drunken altercation, say, and he might or might not go back to work the next week.
Well, I think his big deal, wasn't it, a Barbara Payton love triangle with him? And I mean, this is not, you know, E, but then again, nobody knows, probably for me, knows who Barbara Payton and Tom Neill and Frantz Chautauqua are.
Tends to lament the tribal amnesia that we're afflicted with.
But that was Tom Neill's big deal, was however you say his name, Frantz Chautauqua. He and Tom Neill got into it over Barbara Payton, which is a whole nother story.
Yeah.
But look at the people involved with this. George Jessel is the producer, who apparently the reason he's producer is that he brought the book to 20th Century Fox. Apparently, that's just about all he did to earn the title. And then you've got a woman's director, Edmund Goulding, considered a director of women's pictures, directing this gritty story of the sideshow. And to me, the idea that mentalist tricks, psychology, and the kind of Elmer Gantry-ish thing you mentioned before are all pretty much cut from the same cloth.
Very much from the same cloth, and you should mention in this anyone who admires the central performances, including Burt Lancaster and Elmer Gantry, will really want to discover Nightmare Alley, and that also goes for those who admire Robert Mitchum and Night of the Hunter.
You know, I never thought about that, but you're absolutely right.
It's the same. It's the same kind of let's say demon lurking in plain view.
Yes, yes.
The fiend among us who passes for one of us.
Well,
and, I mean, you've known some guys like that in real life.
We've all known some guys like that in real life. We used to occasionally run into them at the Dallas Festival.
And you really think, what am I doing in this? What am I doing in this company? And then you realize, well, this is society. Get used to it.
That's right. That's
just exactly learn to dodge. The story itself is very simple. The novel is one of those elemental, naturalistic pieces, kind of like, I'm thinking of a Dane Clark film from the same period, Moonrise, or a Spencer Tracy picture that Frank Bozage made in the 30s called Man's Castle, about the other side of life.
The other side of life, like Fred Neill said.
Yes, exactly, and that's the thing that I was attracted to Nightmare Alley as a kid, really too young to appreciate its deeper currents because I had a cousin who ran the Carneys.
Mm-hmm. And I remember you telling me about it.
It sort of came with the territory, and of course that was a forbidden topic within the upstanding sector of the family. Because the carnival was like, well, everybody wants to go, but nobody wants to stay. Because it's, and then this cousin of mine, he was like the prodigal who ran away from home at age 15 and never looked back.
He's kind of like the guy who goes to live in New York City, the good place to visit, but you don't want to live there.
Yes, and of course, when I got old enough as a youngster to go out to the annual carnival appearance on the edge of town, it's like, wow, I could do this too. And of course, like, maybe not.
Well, you know, there's a fascination with the carnival that I think especially comes through in the book. It's not just carnival as metaphor, but it's just a real fascination with maybe the carnival as, I don't want to get too pointy-headed here, but just carnival as a metaphor for life. But if I can say a few words about William Lindsay Gresham, because I've made a study of him.
Gresham is fascinating, and you know that.
Well, he only wrote four books in his lifetime. He wrote some of the later pulps, like a Blue Book and some of the science fiction pulps. He had novelettes and things show up in them, but he only wrote four books. Nightmare Alley is by far the most famous. He also wrote quite a good biography of Houdini, which a lot of people have praised. And then he wrote one called Monster Midway, which speaks to his love of the carny, and there are a series of stories. I believe they're collected because I've found some individual ones in, like, Post and different places like that in the 40s. And then the final one is the most bizarre one. It's called The Wailing Tower, and it's a story of a TB ward on the top of a hospital, and what the people do there as they live out their lives. It's a very strange book. Well, he was... he described himself in one of the biographies. He was, I think, very eaten up with religion, and certainly that's shot through Nightmare Alley. And he called himself an Emersonian freelance, which is a term I used to use as far as his religion went, in a piece in one of those contemporary authors back in the 40s. Well, then he became a Presbyterian and wrote a series of stories for Presbyterian Life magazine, which I have, about his conversion and all this sort of thing, and how he sort of found the way in the Presbyterian Church. And then not all that long after he wrote those pieces, he checked himself into the Fox Hotel in New York under his assumed name and killed himself. So he's an incredibly fascinating guy, and again, I think Nightmare Alley, there's something about Nightmare Alley, Michael, that strikes me as so American in a lot of ways.
Now, honey, don't get yourself all worked up about nothing. I've gone over this in my mind 100 times. If anybody comes back, they're not going to get all steamed up because we fake a little. And another thing, I've met a lot of these spook workers, and they're all hustlers just like me. I didn't see one of them wearing a lightning rod.
But they don't act like you do. They don't talk like ministers.
When did I ever talk like a minister?
Oh, you do it all the time.
I'm talking exactly the same way I did when we were in the nightclub. And I'll tell you another thing. I never mentioned God in the nightclub, did I?
No. I don't think so.
Have I ever mentioned him in this racket? Have you ever heard me do it? Come on. When did I do it?
You haven't,
but... No, I'll say I haven't. I know what I'm doing. I've read the Bible. I can recite the Ten Commandments backwards. And I'll tell you what the third commandment is, too. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. A lot of people think that means swearing, but I'll tell you what it means. It means exactly what you're talking about. I'm not taking any chances, baby. There's nothing to worry about. There's no difference between this and mentalism. It's just another angle of show business.
Wait a minute, mister. You're not talking to one of your chumps. You're talking to your wife. You're talking to somebody who knows you red, white, and blue, and you can't fool me anymore.
Yeah, it is, and that's an important distinction. Like our old buddy Dave Friedman used to make, there is a great difference between the European carnival and the American carnival.
Yes.
The American carnival is really more a microcosm of American life. You find all the elements, the caste system, the royalty and the working class, and you find the people who are there to not only run the grift on the suckers, that is, the customers, but to run the grift on as many of their own kind as they can. And of course, that's what Tyrone Power's character is about. What an offbeat role for a guy associated with swashbuckling, though.
Wasn't it? And, you know, there's also, in addition, you're talking about all the things about the carnival, there's also that whole fascination with the tawdry or the sensational. That I remember a great thing that, you know, as long as we're dropping names here, here's I actually knew the amazing Kreskin a little bit.
Wow.
And the amazing Kreskin and I corresponded some. I did some stories on this, and I was involved in one of the things where he hid, where his paycheck was hidden. You know, he used to do that. And then we came to Tulsa, and then I was one of the ones involved in hiding it, and then we were there when he found it. But he said something to me back then, it was probably in the late 80s, early 90s, and he said, you know, what's sad is that the freak show has moved indoors. And, of course, he was talking about television, and sure enough, and if it was true then, it's incredibly true now. People had to at least go out and try to find it in those days, but it's still the same thing. It's still the same impulse. The impulse that people turn on Jerry Springer and Jersey Shore is the same impulse that made him go out and see the Two-Headed Boy.
Oh, the freak show is on NBC's Today Show now.
Good point.
I mean, the miserable, lost and disillusioned and put upon souls who will invade their own privacy just to get on TV.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, it's the dividing line came when Time Life Incorporated introduced a slick-looking magazine called People, which brought the freak show indoors even further. Next thing you know, we are obsessed. I mean, the obsession with celebrity has always been there since the day of Hearst, if not before. But I think the trigger that allowed things like Jerry Springer, like Oprah Winfrey, and its willingness to exploit human misery for the sake of a good cry, right up to the modern day, it's like, you can't pick up a copy of Time today without seeing the slop over from People.
Right. Well,
and it really does not only demonstrate the truth of that observation, but it also demonstrates how inexorably the culture has changed to the point of they don't want to look for it anymore. They want to turn on the box, and there it is.
They want it to be there whenever they want. And there's also, hand in hand with that, the thing that you're talking about with the celebrity, is also the need to be iconoclastic and to tear down our icons. And I once read, and I have no idea if this is true or not, this is pretty grad school, but I once read that one of the reasons America was such an iconoclastic society, one of the theories was that we were, it's a kind of a cultural memory because this country is made up of exiles.
Oh, yeah.
From places where there was royalty and we didn't get along with it. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but it makes a pretty handy argument. And, you know, you talked about People magazine. To me, when I saw it first happen, was The Gong Show.
Oh, God, you got gone. I don't know why they did that. I loved your act. But then again, I love faulty plumbing. Jamie, why did you do that?
Oh, The Gong Show, yeah, which was like the queen for a day.
Yes.
Antecedents like that where you're wallowing in misery, in somebody else's misery in a vicarious manner. The Gong Show, the Gong Show is a prototypical snuff movie.
It is. You're making fun of you are making entertainment based on the degradation of the human spirit.
Yeah. And that's of course the same mentality that David Cronenberg took on in his 1983 movie Videodrome.
Exactly.
Which in turn predicted but didn't raise a big enough warning about the reality TV craze.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Do you know a show called Videodrome?
Video what?
Drome. Videodrome, like video circus, video arena. You know it?
No.
It's just torture and murder. No plot, no characters. Very, very realistic. I think it's what's next.
Then God help us.
Well, I don't know what kind of warnings there are in Nightmare Alley, but it's certainly almost, it's one of those films that almost works. I think one of the pieces I've read about it, the writer said, it's so good that you wish it was better. Is that the feeling you get?
That's the feeling I've always had, and I have gone back many times to test that impression. I think it's the in ending where you really want more than an echo of Todd Browning's Freaks.
You want what the ending was in the book that you...
Yeah, you want what the ending was in the book. You want to know that... you get the impression that he's really not aware of his fate as it has transpired.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And maybe that's what bothers me about the picture.
And an awareness of one's fate while experiencing that eventual outcome is... It may not come in time for the person to change his or her wicked ways, but sure give him something to stew about.
It does indeed. a couple of performances I'd like to talk about in the picture, Michael, and you know, it's a very good cast. I mean, Joan Blondell obviously was past her prime, but she had matured into a wonderful actress, I think.
Well, one's prime is where one is at. I mean, this very, you know, at the risk of sounding... Today is the first day of the rest of your life. It's like, yeah, this is the best time if you make it so.
Right, and she does a very good job, and she was doing some very good character roles at this time, and I love her line as Xena, and she, of course, is the first woman of the three women in the picture who give Tyrone Power the chance to make something of himself or try and lift him up or at least, you know, he thinks he's using them, and in a couple of cases he is. But I really liked Ian Keith in this. I loved Ian Keith in his low-budget films. I loved him in Valley of the Zombies.
Oh my gosh, playing a character with the resonant name of Ormond Merx.
Ormond Merx.
why do I retain that? Well, because it sticks. It's like a Dickens name. Yeah, Ian Keith is it's funny how you see these B movie notables in a bigger picture. Like a lot of the supporting cast in a John Ford film. You can watch The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and see a prominent appearance by the star of Not of This Earth for Roger Corman.
Paul Birch.
Yes, exactly. And it's like Ian Keith showing up in a big picture, comparatively big picture, such as Nightmare Alley. It's like, wow, you mean there's crossover? Of course there's crossover. There's only one show business.
Well, both he and the other guy that I really liked, Taylor Holmes, in it, both of those guys, of course, were stage guys, and the stage guys are taught you just take any role. You know, you may be the lead in one play, and the next play, you may be a spear carrier. And some people say that's why Bela Lugosi, who, of course, came from the stage, Bela Lugosi's career never went where Boris Karloff's career went, because he had that stage thing going. You know, I mean, that idea of take anything that's offered you because there'll be a bigger role coming along maybe next time, you know. Ian Keith, you know, was Vitamin Flintheart in one of the Dick Tracy movies.
Mm-hmm.
And he was...
And a big stage star of the 20s, a big Broadway player of the 20s,
that's right.
Who kept working against all odds and has a tremendously poignant role in Nightmare Alley.
Absolutely. He has a wonderful role and brings the best out in Joan Blondell, I think, too, in their parts together. I have to say, this is apropos of nothing, but this is just one of those factoids that we tend to love here on the podcast. He was in the Rocky Jones, Ian Keith was in the Rocky Jones Space Ranger TV show as Nizram of Regalio.
Oh my gosh, yes.
just in case you're keeping score at home, he was Nizram of Regalio. One of the things I think also, one of the performances, secondary performances, is this, another stage guy, and I think he's wonderfully poignant in it, is a man named Taylor Holmes. Now, his character comes along, his character's named Grendel, and his character comes along toward the end when Tyrone Power's character has graduated the spiritualism racket, and this guy's got a lot of money, and he's going to bring back they're going to bring back the dead wife. Of course, this is basically the part of the film on which everything turns and he finally overextends. But I think Taylor Holmes is wonderful in that part.
Wonderful role, wonderful performance in the role, and the kind of character that Where'd he come from? Wait a minute, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. And the film really does take a sharp left turn at that point.
It really does, although, again, spiritualism, psychology, carnival rot mind reading, I believe mm-hmm. we're being told those are all the same thing. And that's
showbiz yeah. has that kind of kind of dynamic going on in it. Practically everywhere you look, the situation, and of course Nightmare Alley, is very, very similar to that of a vaudeville picture called The Great Flammarion,
mm-hmm.
with Eric von Stroheim as the expert marksman, Mary Beth Hughes as his leading lady, as it were, and of course Dan Duryea in the role, the equivalent of Ian Keith's role here in Nightmare Alley.
Right, right. Were there any performances in Nightmare Alley? I brought up my two favorites. Were there anybody in Nightmare Alley that you were particularly impressed with?
I'm a sucker for Mike Mazurki.
Yeah.
What a face! What a imposing presence! And the guy was one of the first serial thugs in the movies.
Really? What was he in?
My favorite Mazurki of recent experience is the Dick Tracy feature.
Sure.
He did.
Of course, yeah.
Playing Split Face.
I paid him a visit tonight. Funny. When he saw me, he looked just like you look now.
No. No, don't.
Don't be frightened. This knife is very sharp. You won't hurt. I like when I got this face. It wasn't done so nice. Besides, people won't have to look at you. And turn sick at the sight of you.
No, it's no good killing me. She saw you. She knows you. She'll identify you.
I wonder if he and Ian Keith shared notes about making Dick Tracy movies.
I have an idea. I have an idea that guys like that tend to hang together.
That's
the
true.
News hangs high. He's got quite a few appearances in the Forgotten Horrors books.
Yes.
Killer Dill.
Yes.
One of the great rubber reality films. And, of course...
That's the Stuart Irwin one, isn't it?
I beg your pardon?
Is that the Stuart Irwin one, or am I getting
that's,
it mixed up?
That's the one,
yeah.
Where he sees the gangster movie and starts imitating the character.
Right, that's right.
And I've worked a lot with Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The News Hangs High, Bud and Lou in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And did some of the classic film noirs, like Murder My Sweet.
Right. That's right. That's the Dick Powell one, isn't it?
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, and speaking of 20th Century Fox, has a fairly prominent supporting role in my favorite Fox B unit horror picture, Dr. Renault's Secret.
Oh, what a wonderful! You're right. What a wonderful film that is.
Anything with Mike Mazurki.
Well, he does a good job in this one, and you know, when he and he actually shows a pretty good acting range. I'm thinking of the scene toward the end when Tyrone Power's character is outgrown his roots and is embarrassed to have Joan Blondell's character, Mike Mazurki's character, show up.
Uh-huh,
I think
uh-huh.
he does a very nice bit of acting in that.
He's of course, that was what made him so persuasive as a lowbrow thug. He was extremely intelligent and very sensitive to dramatic nuances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you didn't get just the rampaging hoodlum. You got a sense that, hey, this guy's got a soul.
Right, right.
This guy's got some poetry in him.
Yeah.
And of course, you see him recite poetry in the occasional tough guy role, which makes him the classic Damon Runyon character.
Exactly. That's right. Well, you know, I think this film kind of, and I'm not sure if Tyrone Power actually says this. I wrote it down as I was watching the show. Everybody's a mark. There's just different cons,
mm-hmm.
and that really seems to be the message of this picture.
That's a Barnum philosophy, really, distilled to an essence.
True.
And of course, when Barnum said there's a sucker born every minute, he really wasn't referring to gullibility. He was referring to customers. Sucker is a carny term for customer.
Right, right, exactly. Do you, are you a fan of this picture?
I have gone back to this picture time and again since I was a kid, and it was brand new in 1947, so I was like, I'm sure I saw it first during the middle 1950s. And worked a bit with a avant-garde theater company in Texas to produce a stage version of Nightmare Alley, 20 years ago.
Oh, really? Was that the Vest, Hip Pocket Theater?
Hip Pocket Theater, right.
How did that work out?
Did that work with a lot of stagecraft?
A lot of stage. Did you
a whole lot of stagecraft and a whole lot of invention, and it played out beautifully.
Did you do the movie ending, or did you do the book ending?
Did the movie ending, actually. That that was much easier to stage. In fact, it was the same troupe that with which I had worked on Freaks somewhat before.
Yes,
stage version of Todd Browning's Freaks.
Now, you've done a lot with them, and now you did the stage version of Alley-Oop just recently.
Alley-Oop was not too long ago, yeah.
Well, I think we can recommend that people see this. There's not a lot of films like this. It's not a B picture. It doesn't fit neatly into any category. I mean, you could say it's a Tyrone Power picture, so it's an A picture from 20, and it's 20th Century Fox. But it still is just has a little bit more of an edge than the B pictures of the late 1940s had, and more, or the A pictures rather, and more of that B picture film noir mentality, or so it seems to me.
Oh, it plays out very much like the darker episodes of Michael Shane at Fox, the same studio.
Yes.
It plays out a lot like the darker Bees from Columbia, which were darker than Fox, but a little bit raggedier, more shabbier.
Cheaper looking, shabbier.
Cheaper looking. The attitude I get from Nightmare Alley is that it's got a here's the test of a good B movie. Does it have a chip on its shoulder?
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly does.
Even from the director who brought you Dark Victory with
right.
Eddie Davis.
Yeah, right. It's like I think that Edmund Goulding was probably working out some frustrations.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he had done a silent version of Dante's Inferno.
Yes.
He had done some really dark work in the silent pictures. Tolerable David for Richard Barthelmess, the great star of the 20s.
Which I believe was the first film of John Carradine, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that's right, and I'd have to look it up, but we're pretty close on the money there. The typecasting as a maker of women's movies,
yes,
as the trade papers called
yes
them, a director must direct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he also did his share of exploitation. In fact, I think the last Goulding picture I can recall is one of the Teenage Hoodlum cycle of the 50s. Teenage Rebel.
Oh, Teenage Rebel. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right. So he was with Fox just cradle to grave, pretty much, wasn't he?
Well, a valuable, versatile director never wears out unless he allows himself to.
That's true.
It's like I found a really keen trade paper article that Mickey Nealon, the great director of the 20s and 30s,
yes,
had written when he was riding high in Hollywood, and in one of the questions of the interview, I think he was writing the questions and writing the answers.
Sure.
He says, what do you say when your producer asks you the name of your best picture? And Nealon says, I tell him it's the one I'm about to do for him next. And I think that is a kind of an unwritten law in the trade. It's like, yeah, you preserve your integrity as an artist, you preserve your longevity as a money-making artist by improving on yourself every time out.
Right, right. Makes good sense to me. Well, that's Nightmare Alley. Michael, we've got a little bit of business to take care of, and I hope I don't surprise you because I've got a name. We've talked about this, but I don't think we've talked about it recently for the next podcast we're going to do. But first, need to tell you who the first person was to write in to get those Bloody Visions cards.
Oh, how great.
And so it's Jeffrey Dugan of Lamars, Iowa.
The
ice cream capital of the world, I happen to know. Winner of an out-of-print set of the Michael Price Bloody Visions trading cards of mass murderers. Collect them all, kids, and they're really, really a fine set. I have one in my own collection.
I think we've got one ready to go out to Mr. Dugan.
Great. Next week, first person that writes in after this podcast to my website, which is www.johnwooley.com. First one that writes in to that website will get a Hot Schlock Horror from 1992, I think it is.
And what a deal. What a fun book.
Thank you. It is. We did have some fun with that one. Nice Dave Friedman interviews and interviews with several other people who were involved in the business, including Irish McCullough. Or I can send out one of the rare unautographed copies if you wish. The first person to write in can specify autographed or unautographed copies. Michael, I also want to let's plug our latest work and where it can be found, and why don't you go first on that?
Well, I think we ought to drop a hint on the Rondo Award nominated Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, which is sitting right there on the virtual kiosk at Amazon.com.
And so it has been nominated for a Rondo Award?
Holds a Rondo nomination, and as the series has been often nominated in the Rondo Awards, which is kind of like the Oscars of scary business.
And of course, the
new companion volume, Forgotten Horrors Comics and Stories.
Forgotten Horrors Comics and Stories, which is another one of both of those, of course. We're collaborating along with Jan Allen Henderson, and they're available on Amazon.com, as is my new collection. Well, it's a new graphic novel reprinting the 1987 first four episodes of The Miracle Squad, which is the comic book I did with Terry Tidwell, and Gary Dumb was our primary anchor on that one, who, of course, did a lot of the American Splendor stuff
with Harvey
Pekar. And that has come out from Pulp 2.0 Press out in L.A., and Bill Cunningham, the Mad Pulp Bastard. Can you say Mad Pulp Bastard on a podcast, Joey?
I think you're safe.
I had to check with our producer there to make sure.
Yeah.
You know, he's standing there with the scissors. Bill Cunningham and his Pulp 2.0 Press has put out The Miracle Squad, the first four Miracle Squads, is a graphic novel with a lot of extra information, extra features, some of which, Michael, you helped me with by supplying art, because one of the things he suggested was that I cast the Miracle Squad. For those of you who may not know, the Miracle Squad is set in the 1930s at a studio called Miracle Studios, and it's a group of people who work at the studio, including the studio head, who sort of band together and fight crime. And Bill Cunningham's idea was to cast the Miracle Squad with real-life B-picture actors, which we were able to do. And thank you, Michael, for supplying some of the stills for that.
That's what we do, man. That's what we do.
Unfortunately or fortunately, that is what we do. So the Miracle Squad's available on Amazon.com. And next time, one of my all-time favorites, and Michael, I know it's one of yours too because we've talked a lot about it, Lionel Atwill vehicle from that real weird period that Paramount Pictures had with their horror films. Murders in the Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great, I think, unsung horror movies, and just like Island of Dr. Moreau, which of course was a contemporary from
about the same time.
It's got this really creepy undertow, this really unsettling feeling throughout the entire picture. It's rough. Those pictures, what is it, 1932 or 33? I know it's before the production code really had
a year or two before the Legion of Decency got its hooks into Hollywood.
Right, and there's some stuff in it that would be kind of rough today.
Fortunately, I did not get to see Murders in the Zoo until I was grown up. I think I might have had some real zoophobia phobia.
Pyrophantasmophobia. Well, it's a wonderful movie, and we'll be back in a few weeks to talk about that movie. Meanwhile, we want to thank everybody for listening, and you can always write in with comments. Michael, I know you've been very busy. Joey has been real good about having our group. Oh, is that what you call it? Our group?
Oh, yeah, the Facebook group.
Forgotten Horrors Podcast Group. It doesn't cost anything to get in or anything. And Michael, you've been blogging some up there, and I've been enjoying that. We've been hearing from a lot of people. People are joining the podcast. It's great. We're hearing from a lot of the people that we knew back in the Dallas Fantasy Fair.
Oh, the switchboard's lighting up like Christmas.
It is just lighting up like Christmas, and we're just very excited about it. And we just want to thank everybody. But if you want to make comments on the show, you can write my website. You can go to that you can go to that area, right? That place where we have the what is that called again, Joey? I'm a Luddite. The podcast, the Facebook page.
Oh, the Facebook group.
And you can make a comment there.
Yeah.
And so we just want to thank everybody for listening. We're having a great time doing this, and from what we're hearing from folks, they're enjoying it. And what more can you ask for?
That's the way to work it.
Michael, thank you.
Back
soon.
Back with you soon.
Okay.